Then she realized what she was looking at, and her heart leapt. The Kalare Mountains. They rose above them in silent, stark majesty, their enormous peaks casting a shadow over half the starry sky. Bernard murmured in the darkness, "There's not enough flora for me to veil us along that trail. From here on out, if we're seen, we're out of options. You want to do this fast or slow?" Amara's teeth were chattering, but she managed to say, "Fast! I'm almost done!" Bernard took a deep breath, nodded once, and said, "Here we go." Then he kicked his weary horse forward into a listless canter, and Amara followed suit. They hurried up the trail in the dark, and Amara began to feel nervous again. It took her several moments until they were riding over a level patch of trail that must have been the first pass through the mountains to realize why. The immortals' hunting horns had ceased to blow. Light hit them first, painful in the mountain night. The horses, too tired to truly panic, threw back their heads and danced nervously. Amara raised a hand, trying to block the painful glare, the great fury lamps sometimes used in sieges, surely, and felt Cirrus suddenly falter. The First Lord's stretcher crashed to the ground. She sagged in her saddle, saw someone approaching on her right side, and kicked weakly with her right leg. She hit something, but a grip like stone seized her ankle and dragged her off the horse and to the ground. Bernard roared, and she heard his bow hum. She turned her head enough to see an immortal stricken cleanly through one lung with her husband's arrow. The man never slowed his pace, seizing Bernard's belt and hauling him to the ground. Bernard turned as he fell and seized the immortal, reaching for his throat with fury-born strength. The immortal seized Bernard's hands and slowly, steadily, forced them away. Bloody crows! Immortal knights! Bernard's eyes widened, and he clenched his teeth in desperate effort, but to no avail. The immortal twisted suddenly and threw Amara's husband face first to the ground, rapidly secured a lock on one of his arms, and dislocated his shoulder with a single savage motion. Bernard screamed. Amara became aware of more men then, all fully armored, all bearing the shining steel collar of the immortals. She looked around dully. Indeed, the light had come from enormous fury lamps, which must have been moved up by teams of horses long before. Armored men were everywhere. Not 20, or 30, or 50, but hundreds. All of them immortals, and led by knights. Footsteps crunched over the cold, stony ground. Several gauntlets banged to armored chests. A pair of boots appeared before Amara's eyes, and she looked up. A young man stood over her. He was a little taller than average, very thin and dirty. There was something ugly in his eyes, lurking behind contempt and rage and a certain amount of petulance. It took Amara's stunned and weary mind a moment to place the young officer. Kalaris Brensis Minoris, the High Lord Kalaris's son and heir. "I can't believe this," the young man said. "This is the elite team of soldiers First Lord has been sent down with the North Wind. This is what Father's had me slogging all over the bloody swamps for?" Brensis shook his head with disbelief, and almost idly struck Amara across the face with his mailed hand. Pain made her world go white. She felt her neck wrench as it twisted sharply to one side under the force of the blow. "I could have been sleeping in a bed," Brensis snarled. "And instead I'm out here frozen to the balls and bored out of my mind, setting up the trap, worried about a whole cohort of knights sneaking in the back door, and for what?" Amara tasted blood on her tongue. She lifted her head dizzily. Brensis spat. It struck her cheek. "I'm here for this," he snarled. He seized Amara by the hair, baring her throat, and drew his dagger in his other hand. "For two pathetic little sneaks. Two of you. Two." Light hit them first. It washed over Amara's back and shoulders in a sudden wave of warmth and color. as if someone had convinced the setting sun to reverse its course and rise once again over the mountainside behind them. The light cast knife-sharp black shadows over the entire mountain, its luminance so brilliant that the glare of the enormous fury lamps became utterly insignificant. Immortals, knights, and infantry alike cried out in surprise. Brensis turned white, took a step backward, and lifted a hand to shield his eyes, releasing Amara and letting out a low moan of fear. And then came a voice. A voice spoke in a gentle tone that resounded from the stone and the sky, a voice that rang with a depth and richness of power the mountains had not known since their fiery conception, a voice that contained a certain amount of biting amusement as it answered the heir of Calare's question. Gaius Sextus, first lord of Alera, murmured, 3. Chapter 45. Reverberations of Gaius's deep, mellow voice rolled through the mountains and echoed from the hills. Though he had spoken in a murmur, it emanated from the very stones, and Amara felt sure it could have been heard several miles away in every direction. In the wake of that voice, the brilliantly lit mountainside went totally still and silent. Hundreds of immortals remained motionless in their tracks, shielding their eyes and crouching defensively. Brensis stared past Amara, his mouth gaping and working like that of a landed fish. The knight holding Bernard had backed away when Brensis did, and the Count of Calderon slowly sat up, his face white with pain, his shoulder resting at an odd angle to the rest of his body. He traded a glance with Amara, but neither of them spoke, not daring to draw the attention of the enemy to themselves. It was odd, Amara thought, sitting there on the stony mountainside, exhausted, outnumbered hundreds to one by their foes, and yet, for a single endless moment, no one moved, and no one spoke. And then Brensis let out a sound partway between a scream and a moan, and yelled, his voice cracking into a falsetto in mid-word, "Attack! Attack! Kill them all!" The moment was broken. Hundreds of collared immortals let out a furious cry, and steel rasped in a deadly chorus as they drew weapons. They surged forward, the sound of their boots a sudden thunder. Amara found herself at Bernard's side, unarmed and far too weary to take to the air. She felt his hand fumbling for hers as the immortals came for them, and she interlaced her fingers with his, squeezing tight. They both looked away from the charging immortals at one another, and that was how Amara saw the First Lord, in the corner of her vision, raise a hand and murmur another bone-deep word that rose from the very mountain beneath them.
No!
There was a sudden noise, lower than the cries of charging immortals, more piercing than the tread of their boots. It was a rippling staccato of a sound, somewhat like a saw going through wood. Amara turned to stare as every immortal, every single immortal on the mountainside, suddenly convulsed. Their necks twisted sharply, and the snapping bones were the source of the strange sound. And then they fell dead. All of them. 1 second, a force the size of 2 or 3 legion cohorts was howling for their blood. The next, the immortals lay on the ground, twitching and dying, the strange metal collars now bent and misshapen, all deformed so sharply and suddenly that they had broken the necks of the men wearing them. Amara turned to stare. Gaius Sextus hovered perhaps 10 feet above the mountainside, buoyed by a windstream so tightly controlled that it hardly stirred the dirt beneath him. He was wreathed in the orange-gold flame of an autumn sunset that turned his silver-white hair to bronze. The signs of strain and age that had come on as they travelled were gone. In his right hand was a sword of fire, and fire blazed on his brow in a blinding diadem. His eyes were bright and hard, his face hewn from granite, and such was the majesty and power of him that Amara found herself immediately bowing her head, her hand pressed to her hammering heart. Behind her, Amara heard Brensis sob in terror. And then she heard the unsteady rasp of a sword being drawn into a trembling hand.
"Boy," Gaius said, his tone growing gentler, even compassionate. "You have a choice. You may choose to stand with your father against me, or you may choose to live."
Brensis let out a few small, breathless sounds. Then he said,
"I'm not afraid of you."
"Of course you are," Gaius said, "and should be."
And with those words, a blue-white shaft of lightning roared down from the clear night sky and gouged a hole the size of a grave in the solid stone not 5 yards from Brensis's feet.
"I give you one final chance to live," Gaius said, and his voice was no longer gentle. "Choose!"
Brensis sobbed, and his sword clattered to the stony ground. He turned and fled, his boots sliding and scuffing over the mountainside, vanishing into the distance. Amara rose slowly afterward, and had to help Bernard rise with her.
"Well," Gaius said quietly, "that's a relief."
And with that he dropped without ceremony to the ground. The blazing light around him and the light of the fury lamps on the mountain vanished in the same moment.
"A relief, sire?" Amara asked.
Gaius's voice from the darkness sounded calmly weary.
"By all accounts, young Brensis is quite capable at his fury craft, and I have enough to do tonight without putting him down too."
"Sire?" Amara asked.
"Surely," Bernard said, his voice strained. "After killing so many men, one more."
Gaius murmured something, and one of the fury lamps began to give off a much reduced amount of light, enough to let Amara dimly see the First Lord as a vague, tall shape, standing over one of the fallen immortals.
"These," he murmured, "these were not men. Men have wills, good count. Men have choice."
His eyes turned toward Amara for a quiet moment, pausing just long enough to give his last words a subtle weight.
"Kalaris raised these creatures from childhood bound to these accursed collars," Gaius continued. "He took their wills, their choices, away from them. The men they could have been died long before tonight. These were animals. What he did was terrible, yet I cannot help but wish he'd done it to more of his legionaries. Today would be much simplified."
The First Lord's voice tightened, quickened.
"Let us count ourselves fortunate that Kalaris had the collars all made from the same batch."
Amara blinked at him.
"You mean the immortals could have..."
"Killed me?" Gaius asked. He shrugged a shoulder. "Perhaps. In some ways I am no more powerful than any other High Lord."
Amara blinked.
"But sire, what I saw a moment ago..."
"One needn't be omnipotent to overcome every foe, provided one can appear that way in the enemy's mind." He smiled faintly. "True, I have the means to have slain them all, but accidents happen, and the weight of numbers could tell against me just as surely as they did against mice."
His voice broke. He closed his eyes, cleared his throat, and rasped,
"My son."
Amara faced Gaius, silent, watching his face. Not even his discipline could hide the pain in his features, and Amara suddenly ached for the old man. Gaius shook his head briskly and strode toward Amara and Bernard. He put one hand on her shoulder, another on Bernard's. Bernard let out a hiss of discomfort. Then there was a wrenching pop that dragged a muffled curse from his throat.
"There," Gaius murmured. "Try to move it."
Bernard did, rotating his wounded shoulder slowly.
"Tender," he said after a moment, "but it will serve, sire."
Gaius nodded and squeezed Amara's shoulder gently. In that simple gesture, relief and energy seemed to flood into her, weariness washed away before it. She shuddered at the pleasant sensation left when her aches and fatigue vanished.
"Look there," Gaius murmured, and he nodded to the east.
Amara looked. Dozens, even hundreds of green streamers of light flickered through the sky, rising from the earth in wavering lines, almost like luminous smoke. They were spaced miles apart in a regular grid.
"Kalaris's sentinel craftings," Gaius murmured. "He knows where I am, and I dare say he's deduced my goal. Right now, Kalaris is gathering every knight under his command and ordering every legionary in his forces to intercept us. So we have little time."
Amara jerked her head in a nod. "What would you have us do?" Gaius looked back and forth between them.
"Guard my back. I should hate to make you walk all this way only to take an arrow in the kidneys when we've all but reached the finish line."
Drums rumbled from farther up the pass. A low moan drifted through the rocks, the faint basso precursor to a legion marching song that must shortly follow.
"Sire," Bernard cautioned, "I'm not sure what I can do against numbers like that." "His forces are spread out in the field, and he has far fewer knights and legionaries at hand than he might," Gaius said, "which was rather the point of this stealth business, yes."
"True enough, sire," Bernard said, "but 50,000 or 5,000 makes little difference to me."
"I see your point. You need only concern yourselves with his knights. The others will not be an obstacle."
Amara drew in her breath suddenly.
"I understand."
Gaius nodded, eyes sparkling briefly.
"You would."
The marching song of a Kalaran legion became discernible across the mountainside. Gaius turned to face upslope, narrowed his eyes, and raised his right hand above his head. There was a flash, and then a rippling tongue of fire licked up from his fingers. He closed his hand on the hilt of a sword made of stationary flame. Amara recovered her sword and hurried to his side. Bernard followed suit, setting an arrow to his bow. In the pass above, a second body of troops appeared, several cohorts of legionaries marching together in a swift, cohesive formation. The Kalaran legion pressed forward at a quick step, moving steadily toward Gaius's blazing blade.
"Stay behind me," Gaius cautioned them. "Directly behind me."
And then, with a cry of challenge, the suicidally outnumbered First Lord and his retainers charged the oncoming legion. Chapter 46. In 2 years of fighting since the Battle of the Elenarch, Marcus and the First Aleran had never seen the Khanim resort to the use of their bizarre sorceries. In the absence of other evidence, they had concluded that the enemy's ability to use them had died with Saul and the majority of his ritualist compatriots. The conclusion was incorrect. The first shock of the Khanim charge was repelled by the massed ranks of the three Aleran legions. The palisade wall was a light defensive emplacement, as such things were reckoned, but it was critical that the outer wall hold until the engineers could fortify the partial wall remaining around the ruined town at the crown of the hill.
"Now we know why they didn't fortify the ruin," Crassus murmured.
"Why do our work for us?" Marcus grunted.
He raised his voice and shouted,
"Third cohort, dress those ranks!"
The Khanim had withdrawn in good order after their first charge, but a second and larger force of raiders was already in position. In 2 years, Nasorg had drilled his own conscripts into something that resembled an actual military force, and the mass movements of the raiders, which had originally been slow, confused, almost tidal, had become disciplined and precise. Their armament had changed as well, Marcus noted. They had taken the handheld scything swords, originally harvesting implements for goodness sake, the Khanim raiders had used, and mounted them on thick wooden shafts, effectively changing what had been a close-fighting implement into a weapon with far greater reach, one more suited to assaulting a defended position. Marcus watched the assault coming and felt his heart pounding in fear as the oncoming Khanim let out howls and bellowed battle cries. The raiders smashed into the palisade like a living tide of muscle and steel. The Khanim raiders fought with far more skill and tenacity than they had at the Battle of the Elenarch, and the new hafted weaponry proved deadly. Over and over Marcus saw the same brief, hideous tableau repeated. A Khanae raider would swing his hafted scythe overhead and straight down in a smashing two-handed blow. The tip of the scythe would land hard against the top of a legionare's helmet, and with the power and weight and leverage of a full-sized Khanae behind the blow, the tip of the simple weapon would pierce even Alaren's steel straight down through the top of the helmet and into the skull of the doomed legionare beneath. It was a deadly tactic. The foe could adjust his aim with relative ease, and there was no practical way for a legionare fighting in close formation to dodge the diving tip of the Khanim's scythes. Marcus brought his own shield up in time to catch the inner edge of a scythe falling toward his skull and dropped to one knee. The scythe's edge managed to carve straight down through the steel of his shield, despite the strength of the standard legion battlecraft that strengthened it. Marcus grunted, summoning strength from the earth to twist the shield, trapping the weapon, and with a powerful blow of his gladius, he parted the wooden haft from the scythe head, drove a wounding blow into the Khanae before him, and fell back, trying to clear the weapon head from his shield, while another legionare shouldered into his position, and was promptly felled by a falling scythe, as the Khanae Marcus had wounded was replaced just as swiftly as he had been. After that it became a desperate nightmare of a battle. The legion's spears were not long enough to outreach the Khanim haft scythes, and their comparatively slender wooden shafts were easily shattered by the sharpened inner curves of the scythes. The legionnaires, fighting on raised mounds of earth behind the palisades, fought nearly eye to eye with the Khanim, and it did them no favours. The second rank could not press up onto the earthworks and employ their shields to shelter their compatriots in the first rank, and the legion's favored tactic, the steady press forward with murderous swords thrusting and chopping between minuscule openings in the shield wall, was simply not an option from the defensive position. It was, Marcus reflected grimly, a tactic that would have made short work of the Khanim. A steady press inside the reach of the Khanim haft scythes would leave the weapons all but useless, but fighting from a static position, the foe's new armament was taking a savage toll on the legion. The Khanim broke the ranks on the earthworks almost at will, but never pressed their advantage. Why should they? More and more legionaries stepped up to fight, and more went down, helms shattered. Even the heavily layered shoulders of their body armor could not wholly turn aside the force of a well-swung Khanim haft-scythe, and the toll of dead and wounded steadily mounted.
"Sir!"
Marcus shouted at Crassus. The young officer was near the front ranks of the battle, and as Marcus watched, he stepped up over a wounded legionare, his face a mask of determination, as a Khanae swung a haft-scythe in a finishing blow. Crassus's sword lashed out, and the young citizen's blade shattered the steel of the Khanim weapon in one swing and wounded the Khanae holding it in another. Crassus seized the fallen man and dragged him back, while other legionaries pressed up to take his place.
"Sir!"
Marcus screamed.
"We've got to press them, sir! We've got to push them back before they cut the men apart!"
"No!" Crassus bellowed. "Hold the line! You hold that wall until the engineers signal us, first spear!"
Marcus's instincts and experience screamed that Crassus was making the wrong choice, that his naturally conservative tendencies as a commander, which were so ideal in other circumstances, were fatally flawed this day. The First Alaren could ill afford such a mistake in leadership. But it could afford a loss of unity even less.
"You heard the man," Marcus bellowed, urging his men forward. "Hold the wall! Hold! Hold!"
He had no idea how much time went by. He was briefly blinded twice, once by the blood of a Khanae, and again by the blood of a veteran legionare named Barras. He was once caught off guard by a haft scythe, and only the raised crest of his centurion's helmet kept him from sharing Barris's fate. The carne weapon left a deep crease in his shoulder armor, and the straps and edges beneath cut into his flesh, but he kept fighting, kept supporting his men, desperately clearing the wounded from the line and urging fresh legionaries into the fight. After a lifetime, the trumpets began to blare up higher on the hill. The engineers had finished their work.
"Fall back!" Marcus screamed to his men in the tumult. "Fall back to the wall!"
The Carnim howled and surged forward as the Alaran legionaries began to withdraw from the palisade. They hacked into the wooden barrier, chopping away enough material to create myriad openings, and began to press the retreating legionaries. Without the knights and the reserve waiting on the hill, it could have become a rout. Several cohorts broke altogether, but Marcus somehow kept the prime from fragmenting, withdrawing step by step up the hill, fighting all the way. Where discipline began to fail, teams of knights smashed into the Carnim lines, and now the haft scythes, so deadly in one circumstance, became hindrances in another. Knights Terra and Ferris smashed through the weapons like toys, piling up fallen Carnim like cordwood, and the cavalry's initial charges down the hill left windrows of dead behind. It would be enough, Marcus saw, as Antilla Maximus, a long blade in either hand, plunged through the ragged remains of the decimated ninth cohort and shattered the fragile momentum a squad of raiders had gathered to pursue their advantage. The first Alaran was steadily gaining the security of the thicker stone walls of the ruin, fighting in a shrinking half-circle as the men at the rear retreated. Without being ordered, he positioned the prime at the outer edges of the defense. They would be the last cohort to gain the walls. A flight of knights Aeris screamed by, low enough to employ their spears, spitting Carnim entirely with the speed of their passing. One man weaved aside from an upraised scythe, but the weapon's point caught in his armor or gear, and he was hauled down into a howling mob of furious raiders. As the knights Aeris completed their pass and arced around for another, men began to drop, wounded or killed by Carnim ballists, and they were forced to withdraw. Increasingly it was the efforts of the close combat knights that made the critical difference as the Carnim surged forward into the steadily shrinking Alaran lines. Showers of missiles from the newly crafted walls slowed some of the Carnim, but there were simply not enough missiles in enough concentration to break them, and the knights had to expend more and more effort, now fighting into the ranks with the legionaries. That was when the Carnim unleashed their sorcery once again. Marcus had little time to gawk, but he did catch a patch of unusual motion at one of the fallen palisades. A number of Carnim figures in mantles of pale, pale leather appeared, filing steadily forward, swinging lit braziers in rhythm in front of them. They fell into a line facing the hill, and then, as one, reached their clawed hands into gaping pouches slung across their bodies. They withdrew their hands as one single motion, sending out splattering arcs of scarlet liquid, and as one body the ritualists threw their heads back and howled. Lines of violet flame sleeted suddenly from the skies. They struck the hillside near the distinctively deadly forms of the battling knights and erupted into spheres of hellish fire and light. Men screamed and died, and if the skyfire wasn't the enormous destructive force that had struck the first Alaran at the Elenarch 2 years before, the more precise, smaller eruptions of fire certainly struck with telling effect. The Alaran lines collapsed. Marcus screamed orders, dragged at wounded men, and had no idea how he managed to avoid all the Carnim weapons that came screaming at him. He remembered felling one Carne that had leapt upon a badly burnt knight he recognized as Maximus, and then his weapon was struck from his hand. He fell on Antilla's wounded form, covering them both with his shield, and then there was a flash of steel, and Crassus was at his side, long blade in his right hand, and the curved, heavy blade of a Carne dagger in his left. Crassus dealt two death strokes in as many seconds, driving the Carnim back. "Inside!" he screamed, and rushed forward. It was not a second too soon. Another delicate-looking line of violet sky fire descended upon him and exploded into a blinding sphere of heat and light. A second later it was gone, leaving a circle of blackened earth behind it, and Crassus with it, untouched by the fire, the blood-red gems in the hilt of the Carnim dagger glittering in the lowering light. A fresh round of cheering howls from the Carnim raiders died abruptly as Antyllus Crassus unleashed the power of the son of a High Lord of Alera upon their ranks. Fire engulfed his blade and lashed out in a wave, washing over 100 of the inhuman warriors. Somewhere a ballist hummed, but Crassus's blade intercepted the blurring missile in a shower of sparks, deflecting it. At his cry, a sudden vortex of wind formed, spinning the ashes and gravel and dust of the hillside into a blinding cloud, shielding the remnants of the prime cohort from the sight of most of the enemy. Marcus got to his feet and seized Maximus by the armor. He dragged him backward, bumped into the wall, and was guided by the hands of other legionaries to the opening. He retreated through it, shaking with fatigue, and fell to the ground in exhaustion. Seconds later, Crassus bounded through the opening, and half a dozen legion engineers rushed forward, laying their hands upon the stone of the wall. The opening quivered and began to shrink, and in seconds it was gone altogether, the stone of the wall smooth and unbroken. Outside the walls of the ruins, the heavy braying horns of the Carnim began to sound. "They're retreating!" shouted someone on the wall. "They're falling back!"
"Healer!" Marcus rasped.
He turned to Maximus and found the young man lying senseless, burned and bleeding.
"Healer!"
"Easy," said a voice. "Easy there, first spear."
Crassus eased Marcus back and away from Maximus.
"Go ahead, Foss."
Marcus watched them carry Maximus away. Someone guided his steps to one side and sat him down with his back against a wall. He found a mug of water in his hands and gulped it down at once, then a second and a third. Food came next, and though it was only plain mashed oats, he emptied the bowl and licked it clean. Only after he had attended to the screaming needs of his body did he manage to look up, gathering his wits again. Lady Aquitaine, in her washerwoman guise, stared at him expressionlessly. Then she went back to passing out bowls of food, such as they were, and fresh water to the exhausted legionaries, who were scattered all over the ruins nearby. Other domestics tended to minor injuries and brought replacements for weapons lost or broken in the fight. Battle-weary soldiers wolfed down food, gulped water, or simply lay in senseless heaps on the ground, asleep, as they did after practically any battle, much less one as strenuous as this one. Marcus felt like a mound of worn-out boot-leather and wanted nothing more than to join them. Instead, he pushed himself to his feet and started stumping around the immediate area, locating his men as the light faded from the sky. Of 80 spear leaders in the prime, 29 were still fit for duty, including himself. A quarter of his legionaries were wounded and out of action. Another quarter were dead or missing. And in the savage battleground they'd left behind, missing probably meant that they'd been too badly mangled to be identified as the Legion withdrew. Another quarter of his men were lightly wounded and awaiting their turn with the healers. In the merciless mathematics of war, lightly wounded legionaries were treated first by the Legion's watercrafters and returned to duty. Those more heavily wounded were generally stabilized, and then suffered, until there were resources enough to get them back on their feet. As he took count of his men at the healer's station, Marcus saw a lot of Alarans suffering. He went around to the Legion's 15 tribunes. 3 were dead, 3 more were injured and out of action, including Antilla Maximus, whose injuries relegated him to the category of those awaiting additional medical resources. The tally of losses was sobering. The report from the Tribune Logistica was even more so. Marcus found Crassus where he probably shouldn't have been, visiting his half-brother on a cot in the healer's tents, alongside all the other men too badly hurt to be easily put to right. The young man sat beside Maximus, his expression remote.
"Captain," Marcus said quietly.
"You were right," Crassus said without preamble.
"'We should have sortied,' Marcus ignored his words. "'We're at half our normal fighting strength, sir. "'More than a third of our supply train was cut off "'as they tried to make it inside the palisade, "'most of it our livestock. "'And the only well we can reach on this hilltop has been poisoned. "'The Tribune Logistica is working on a way of filtering the water, "'but it doesn't look promising. "'We've already gone through most of what we had in barrels "'from the wells down the hill.' So unless we get some rain, or Tribune Simnea manages a minor miracle, we're going to be fighting dry. It was a death sentence for a legion. A legion might manage a day without food, but without water men would drop by the score every few moments, unable to fight.
I was so sure we had to hold, Crassus said, to tough it out for a few moments more. I thought that any minute the walls would be ready and we'd stand them off like before. I thought that we must have drawn the heaviest attack, that the guard would be able to reinforce us.
He gestured at his fallen brother. Maximus was covered by light sheets, and Marcus knew that the healers had done it to keep dirt and grime out of the burns.
Max was right, Crassus said. I thought too much, Marcus. And he's suffered for my sins. Again.
Marcus stared at the back of the young man's head for a moment. If Lady Aquitaine saw Crassus like this, she'd be hard-pressed to hide her satisfaction. He could be no threat to her liegeman Arnus's military laurels like this. It would probably never occur to her that in their current circumstances there would be no laurels bestowed, no honours conferred, except, of course, the posthumous ones. He walked around to the young officer's front, saluted, and slapped him sharply across the mouth. Crassus blinked and stared at the first spear in perfect shock. It hadn't been a gentle slap. Blood trickled from the young man's lower lip.
"Crows take you, sir," Marcus said quietly. "You are a legion captain, not some teenage bride mooning over her husband off to war. Get off of your ass and lead. Before more men wind up like your brother."
Crassus just stared at him blankly. It occurred to Marcus that it was entirely possible that no one had spoken so to the young man in his entire life.
"Stand up," Marcus growled. "Stand up, sir."
Crassus stood up slowly. Marcus faced him and banged his fist to his chest in another salute. Crassus responded in kind. He studied Marcus for a moment, nodded slowly, and said, his voice very quiet, "Half strength, no meat, no water."
"Aye, sir."
"The guard?"
"I spoke to their first spears, sir. They're in worse shape than we are. For all practical purposes, we've got the only knights on the field. The guard used a different model of helmet than we did, without the crossbars on the crowns. And those hafted scythes went through them like paper. They've got fewer wounded, but a lot more dead."
"Orders from the senator?" Crassus asked.
Marcus shook his head.
"The other captains?"
"No word from them either, sir."
Crassus drew in a deep breath.
"It seems to me we really ought to have some kind of plan." "If you say so, captain."
"Send runners to the senator and the other captains," Crassus said. "Inform them that I've prepared a pavilion for him, his staff, and the other captains, and that it is ready to receive him immediately."
Marcus saluted and turned to go.
"Marcus,"
Crassus said quietly. He paused without turning back. Crassus dropped his voice until only the two of them could have heard it.
"We aren't getting off this hill, are we?"
Marcus blew out a breath.
"Doesn't look like it, sir."
Crassus nodded.
"Thank you," he said.
Marcus went on about following his orders, though he was ready to allow the Kernim to kill him, if only they promised to let him get a few moments of sleep first. Chapter 47 Troops surged from concealed positions beside the road, a dozen Kernim and twice as many men in the worn gear of the Free Alaran Legion. One moment no one was in sight, and the next a formidable array of weapons was pointed directly at Tavi's chest.
"Well,
Tavi said, his tone impatient as he reined his nag to a halt. "It's about bloody time." One of the men had begun to speak, but he blinked and simply stared at Tavi, evidently surprised to be so addressed. Tavi studied him for a moment and decided that he was the most advantageous point of attack. If he didn't manage a successful verbal assault with the first pickets around Mastings, it might take him hours or days of waiting to get to Nasorg, and he doubted his mother and Araris would have that long. "You," Tavi said, pointing at the man, then indicating the wooden baton thrust through his belt. "Centurion, I take it?"
"Yes," said the young man.
"Yes, I'm... Don't you people watch the back door as closely as the front? Bloody sloppy." The man's face turned red.
"Now, see here. You are intruders on a free Alaran causeway, and as such I am placing you under arrest in accordance with general order..."
"I don't have time to listen to you cite phrase and paragraph, Centurion," Tavi said, his tone striking a fine balance of impatience and authority, all of it absent of malice. "Lead me to Nasorg at once." One of the Khanim, a warrior Khane decked in the dark red-black steel plate of his caste, narrowed his blood-coloured eyes and growled in Khanish to one of his companions, a raider.
"Spit him on your spear. We'll see how much talking he does then."
Tavi turned and stared hard at the Khane who had spoken. Their battered group was not calculated to impress, and consisted of one mounted but unarmored man on a horse who had seen better days, and one rickety wagon drawn by a pair of shaggy mules, driven by a Marat girl, and carrying an unclad Khane and a wounded traveler. They could hardly have passed as bandits, much less anyone of importance enough to demand an audience with the Khanim's leader. And if Tavi allowed the warrior Khane to treat them as petty vagrants, they would doubtless be tossed into a cell to languish through being passed from one officer to the next, up the chain of command, and the entire enterprise of the last several weeks could come to nothing. Varg could probably establish his credentials in fairly short order, but Tavi's instincts warned him not to ask the Khane to do so. Varg had agreed to follow and support him until they reached Nasorg, but only so long as Tavi behaved in a fashion appropriate to a leader. Among the Khanim warrior caste, leaders did not detail matters of personal precedence to their subordinates. They established such guidelines themselves. It was how one became a leader in the first place. Tavi had to establish himself, by himself, at once. And when it came to dealing with a Khane, actions undeniably spoke far more than words. So without another word, Tavi swung down from his horse and stalked over to the Khane, staring hard at his eyes. Tavi stopped about 6 feet from the warrior and said, in the wolf warrior's own snarling tongue,
"Say that again, please. I didn't hear you."
The Free Alaran soldiers stared. Every single Khane in sight turned his head toward Tavi, ears swiveled entirely forward. The warrior Khane lowered his chin, and a warning growl bubbled in his chest. Tavi let out a bark of harsh laughter, showing his own teeth in response.
"Is that supposed to frighten me?"
The warrior Khane rested one hand on the hilt of his sword.
"Do you want your blood to stay where it is, Sochalah?"
Tavi lifted both eyebrows at the unfamiliar word and glanced at Varg.
"Monkey,"
Varg supplied in Alaran.
"And male child."
"He called me monkey boy?" Tavi asked. Varg nodded. Tavi nodded his thanks and turned back to the warrior Khane.
"Take me to Nasorg,"
Tavi told him.
"Now."
The Khane lifted his lips from his teeth.
"Drop your sword and pray that I choose to be merciful, monkey boy." "Will it take long for you to talk me to death?" Tavi asked. "I can't help but wonder why you, a warrior, are out here leading a group of makers and monkeys guarding a back road badly. Are you too useless for an actual fight?"
The Khane let out a snarl and moved, sword sweeping from its sheath as he leapt at Tavi. Tavi hadn't expected quite that strong a reaction, but he'd been ready to move since the moment he'd dismounted. He borrowed speed from the wind and slowed everything that happened, drawing his sword to meet the Kane's, pulling strength from the earth and twisting the whole of his body, hips and shoulders and legs, to strike against the Kane's weapon with all the force he could summon. The Alaran Gladius rang against the blood steel of the Kane's sword and shattered it in a scream of tortured metal. The Kane staggered, thrown off balance, and Tavi bulled forward low, sword sweeping in a cut aimed at the back of the Kane's armored leg. The Kane jerked his leg clear of the blow that could have severed tendons and rendered him immobile, and Tavi rammed his shoulder into the Kane's belly with all the power of his body and fury craft, actually lifting the huge wolf warrior clear of the ground before slamming him to the earth on his back. The Kane's breath exploded from his lungs in a croaking snarl, and before he could recover, Tavi had seized one broad ear in an iron grip and set the tip of his sword against the Kane's throat.
"I am Rufus Scipio," Tavi said calmly, "captain of the 1st Alaran Legion, defender of the Elenarch. I have faced the massed ranks of your army alone and unarmed. I killed the Bloodspeaker Saul by my own hand. And," he added, "I beat Nasorg at Ludus. I have come to speak to Nasorg, and you will take me to him."
The warrior Kane stared at him for several seconds. Then his eyes flicked to one side, and he tilted his head slightly, baring his throat. Tavi released his grip on the Kane's ear and returned the gesture, more shallowly. The Kane's ears twitched in what Tavi had come to recognize as a motion of surprise. Tavi lowered the sword and backed away without letting his guard down. Then he sheathed the weapon and nodded to the Kane.
"Get up. Let's move."
The Kane growled as he pushed himself up, but tilted his head to one side again and gestured to the other Kanim there. He turned to the Alaran centurion and said in mangled Alaran,
"I leave the post in your care, centurion."
The centurion looked from the Kane to Tavi, his face full of questions, but he saluted the Kane, Alaran style, and began giving orders to the other men there. The Kane growled to his countrymen, and the Kanim fell into a loose formation around Tavi, who mounted his horse again and pulled it up next to the wagon.
"How is he?"
he asked Varg quietly, looking down on Aaron's ashen face.
"Sleeping,"
Varg replied. The Kane held steady the quill that still protruded from the slit in Aaron's neck, allowing him to breathe.
"Alaran," Kitai said, a note of reprimand in her voice. "If I must drive the wagon, it would be courteous of you to let me handle the fighting."
Varg's ears flicked in amusement.
"Next time," Tavi told her.
He glanced at Varg and arched an eyebrow in silent question.
"Your grammar is terrible," Varg said.
He glanced up at the warrior Kane as he signalled his men, and their group and its new escort started down the road.
"But you make yourself understood, Gadara. Calling him useless may have been more than was necessary to goad him."
Tavi grunted.
"It is an insult word to your kind?"
Varg snorted again.
"Rear area duties such as this are often assigned to overly aggressive young warriors. To temper them, they often resent it."
Tavi nodded in understanding.
"I'm just glad I didn't have to kill anyone to get through."
"Why?"
Varg asked.
Tavi glanced back at the Kane.
The question had been delivered in a neutral, almost casual tone, but Tavi sensed that there was more to it than that in Varg's mind.
"Because it would be a waste of a life that could be better spent elsewhere," he said.
Varg looked at him steadily.
"And perhaps because your people do not all enjoy killing for its own sake."
Tavi thought of Navaris's flat, reptilian eyes and suppressed a shiver.
"Perhaps."
Varg's chest rumbled in a low, pensive growl.
"You begin to understand us, I think, Gadara. And perhaps I begin to understand you."
"That," Kitai said in an acerbic tone, "would be remarkable."
They reached Mastings in the midst of the afternoon, The Khanim, Tavi saw at once, had turned the city into a veritable fortress, with multiple ranks of earthworks and palisades surrounding a solidly crafted curtain wall leading up to full 30-foot siege walls around the town itself. The outermost wall was lined with both Free Alaran and Khanim troops, and at the gate they were challenged by another warrior Khane. The leader of their escort went forward to speak with the sentry, and Tavi paused, looking around. The conversation between the two Khanim became animated, but no louder. The Khane at the gate beckoned an older Alaran man over, and the three of them met in a quiet conference. The man glanced at Tavi and frowned, and Alaran sentries on the wall began to gather in, overlooking the group at the gate. "We've attracted attention," Kitai noted under her breath.
"That was the idea," Tavi replied.
10 minutes later, no one had come to speak to them, but a runner had been dispatched toward the city, and a rider had left the gates, riding hard toward the north. Another half-hour passed before a group of horsemen emerged from mastings and made their way through the extra defensive walls until they finally reached the outermost wall. As they did, Tavi squinted at the outer wall, then at all the positions on the inner wall, where thousands of uniformed figures stood on guard.
"Kitai," Tavi breathed quietly, "look at the guards on the second wall and farther in, and tell me what you see."
Kitai frowned at them for a silent moment, and then spoke suddenly.
"They aren't moving. At all."
"They're scarecrows," Tavi said quietly. "Imitations. Only the guards on the outer wall are real."
"Why?"
Kitai breathed.
"To put the legions off their guard," Tavi said quietly. "The scouts would never have gotten this close to the city to see through it. They'd report back that the city was heavily occupied, and the legions would count on 20,000 troops at least being behind the city walls, under observation, safely located. Then Nasorg could bring the actual troops in unexpectedly."
"Nasorg is not planning on fighting a siege as we thought," Kitai said.
"No. He met us in the field, probably before we could dig in."
Tavi shook his head.
"Crows, he's good."
Varg growled thoughtfully.
"You beat him at Ludus?"
Tavi glanced back over his shoulder at Varg.
"During a truce to allow him to recover the bodies of his warriors. His game on the skyboard isn't as strong as it could be, and he underestimated me."
"Understandable," Kitai noted. She glanced at Varg. "I was also unimpressed with the Alaran on our first meeting."
Varg glanced at Kitai, and his jaws parted briefly in amusement, his ears quivering in emotion Tavi had never seen in a Khane before. They fell silent as a group of mounted horsemen approached from the gates of Mastings, riding swiftly. The horses pulled up to a halt only a few feet away from them, and the officer who led the group, presumably a tribune, judging by his more modern and well-fitting armor, flung himself from his horse, his face already scarlet with rage.
"What have we here?" he demanded. "Some of the scum at last!"
He whirled on a man in a centurion's crested helmet and stabbed an accusing finger at the ground directly before Tavi.
"Centurion! I want the gallows constructed right here!"
Tavi narrowed his eyes, and he traded a glance with Kitai. The centurion banged his fist to his chest and began giving orders to the Free Alaran riders. The legionaries began hurrying about at once, and someone returned with rough lumber within a moment. Their Khane escort let out a rumbling growl in his throat, watching the angry tribune with narrowed eyes, but he did not move or speak. Tavi waited a moment before it occurred to him that he was in the same situation with the young warrior Khane as he was with Varg. He'd declared himself the Khane's superior, and any responsibility for acting in a dispute belonged to him. He nudged his horse forward a few steps and said,
"Excuse me, tribune. Might I ask what you think you're doing?"
The red-faced tribune whirled on Tavi in a fury, one hand on his sword.
"Centurion!"
he bellowed.
"Sir, the next time the condemned speak, you will carry out their executions at once. Sir!"
Tavi met the tribune's hard eyes for a long moment, but he didn't speak. He glanced aside at Kitai. The Marat girl's expression didn't change, but she shifted position on the driver's bench of the wagon and reached back to adjust the unconscious Aaron's clothing. Tarvi never saw any indication of it, but he was sure she had palmed one of the many knives Aaron habitually secreted about his person. From the set of his ears, Varg took note of it. He glanced up at the young Kane, whose ears suddenly flattened to his skull. Tarvi suppressed a grimace. If it came to a fight, they'd have no chance. Not even if the young warrior and his entire patrol joined in. There were simply too many of the Free Alaran Legionaries about. And in any normal Alaran Legion, the orders of a tribune would draw immediate support from every Legionari and Centurion in sight. Another rider came galloping up from the city, kicking his horse the entire way, and when the beast arrived it was in a near frenzy. It screamed and reared, hooves lashing, and the rider dropped off, threw off his helmet, and drew his gladius from his belt. Tarvi recognized him immediately, though the last time he had seen Dureus, his features hadn't been mottled with rage. Something was happening here, something more than merely tension during a time of war. There was far too much emotion in the reaction of the Free Alarans, and such things didn't occur for no reason. It didn't bode well for their situation. Men in such an excited state of mind were capable of anything. Tarvi tensed, readying himself to borrow the wind and draw his sword before anyone could stop him, but Dureus stalked over to the hard-eyed tribune and without a word fetched him a blow to the face with the back of his empty hand. The tribune reeled. Dureus lifted his sword and shoved it hard against the tribune's armored chest, forcing the man to the ground.
"Stand up," Dureus snarled, "and I will strike off your useless head, Manus."
The tribune looked up in a fury.
"Centurion, I will have your head for the—"
Dureus leaned back and kicked Tribune Manus in the mouth with the heel of one foot. The man's head snapped back in a sudden spray of broken teeth, and he flopped to the ground, unconscious. Dureus glared at him, then at the nearby centurion.
"In his cups again."
The centurion's mouth twisted in distaste, and he nodded.
"Then get him something harder," Dureus said. "If he's too drunk to walk, he'll be too drunk to do something this stupid. Now put the crow-begotten lumber back and get those horses back to the stables."
The centurion nodded and immediately began giving orders that were more or less the precise opposite of those he had just uttered. The legionaries collected the unconscious tribune and carried him off. The blocky Dureus, who looked even blockier dressed in armor than he had in a scout's field clothes, turned and walked over to Tarvi, putting his sword away as he came. He nodded to Tarvi as he approached.
"Captain?"
"Dureus," Tarvi said. "Nice to see you again, all things considered."
The Free Alaran centurion twitched his mouth into a faint smile.
"I wish I could say the same. We need to get you away from here."
"Not until I speak to Nasorg," Tarvi said. Dureus narrowed his eyes, glancing from Tarvi to the wagon and its passengers and back.
"You're kidding."
"This doesn't seem the appropriate place for levity," Tarvi said.
"I need to see him."
"You need to be elsewhere," Dureus insisted.
"Fortunately, in this case, the two aren't exclusive. Nasorg's in the field."
Tarvi grimaced as Dureus confirmed his guess regarding Nasorg's plans.
"I see. Lead the way, then."
"Aye."
Dureus went back to his horse and swung up without bothering to use the stirrups, hauling himself up purely by the muscles in his chest and arms. He nodded to their Kane escort and said,
"Thank you, Sarsh. I'll take them from here."
The Kane tilted his head casually to one side and growled,
"Watch the one on the horse. He's quicker than he looks."
Dureus nodded, frowning, and said,
"This way."
They followed Dureus away from Mastings and toward the north. Once they were well away from the city walls, Tarvi urged his horse up alongside the Free Alarans.
"That was quite a reception committee," he said quietly.
"What brought that on?" Dureus glanced aside at Tarvi, his expression unreadable.
"Isn't it obvious?"
"Not to me," Tarvi said. "I've been away a while."
Jurius exhaled through his teeth.
"Of course you'd say that," he murmured almost to himself.
He glanced back at the wagon.
"That's Varg?" "I'll speak to Nasorg about that,"
Tavi said quietly. Jurius shrugged.
"Fair enough. Then I'll let Nasorg answer your questions as well."
Tavi grunted, but nodded.
"One thing more. One of my men is hurt. He needs a healer before we can go any farther."
"He can't have one," Jurius snapped.